The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today we're going to talk about something that's very near and dear to me, something I've been dealing with for a good portion of my adult life. And that is medieval political ideas, and in this case, the political ideas of the medieval West in the 13th and 14th century. And this is an era where political ideas exploded in Western Europe, and you had a tremendous innovation in political and social ideas. This is going to be a two-part program, in that I have a lot to talk about. Well, way too much for one talk. I do want to cite at least one of my sources, really one of the best articles on this topic. Secondary pieces, of course, a 1928 article in Speculum, written by Lester Kruger Bourne. Speculum is really one of the standard journals in medieval studies, and every once in a while you come across a piece that's particularly good, and that it's able to synthesize and add some new ideas to some very old concepts. And what Bourne is dealing with is a lot of writers who have largely been forgotten, with a couple of exceptions. A lot of these guys are very, very obscure. Historians of political ideas, of which I am one. That's my actual area of doctoral training. My PhD is actually in the history of political ideas, so it's both political, historical, and to add to that, also philosophical. So, but historians of political ideas will recognize people like John of Salisbury, and even Marsilio of Padua, which we're going to deal with. But for today, we're only going to deal with three people, three major early figures. The first, John of Salisbury in Great Britain, who is probably the most famous of this group, Giraldus Cambrensis, and Gilbert of Tournai. All three of these guys are relatively, they're all functioning within the High Middle Ages. And they are all dealing with various aspects of what a good monarch is, what a good ruler is, and the nature of the good state, and most of all, what a good law is, and how we know a good law from a bad law. And the reason I'm doing this, this is number one, that I'm a medievalist. I've been a medievalist my whole life, my whole adult life. And number two, to resurrect some ideas that have been forgotten for a long period of time. But number three, and most importantly, I want to make it clear that a lot of these medieval writers had it right, and a lot of the modern writers had it wrong. Now, I don't want to be too severe in this, because there's a lot of good writers in the modern era. Savchenko in the East, and Herder in the West, and so many others, you know. But these guys, they stress the virtue that a ruler and lawgiver must have, rather than the classic modern idea that what's stressed are institutions and constitutions and groups of people. These guys have a tendency to talk about individual princes, monarchs, what virtues someone should have, if they should even begin to want to have political power, versus what they actually should do once they have political power. So it's a pretty radical distinction from what we normally deal with in modern political ideas. So this is going to be a two-part program, at least, but I'm going to make sure to get everything in two parts. We're going to deal with three people tonight, like I said, John Giraldus and Gilbert, and the next time we're going to deal with William Perrot, Egidius Romanus, Jacques Pierre Mozilio, and Thomas O'Cleve. And we'll deal with these people some other time. But today we're going to deal with three major individuals in 13th, early 14th century political theory. And we're going to see what they have to say and see how we could use these people to understand our current situation, which, of course, is way beyond a crisis. We're now in a period of absolute destruction and meltdown. So we're going to begin with the most famous, John of Salisbury, an Englishman who is a royalist. He believes that the monarch is subject only to God, and that God is the one who decides who's going to rule what. John of Salisbury is known for what we're going to talk about later on as the one of the leaders in the organic movement in political ideas, the organic metaphor that holds that the state, society, is analogous to the human body. And this is going to create some controversy in the Middle Ages and, of course, later on. But putting it simply, the monarch is the head, the Senate is the heart, and the peasants are the feet. And but what John is interested in more than anything else is that the monarch is the head, and the head is the coordinator of every other part of the social system. And John is, he's when you read about John of Salisbury in the literature, and there's a lot on him, actually, and he's probably worth your time reading about because he's very interesting. Usually people deal with his organic metaphor, how the state is like the human body and what the fingers are and what the arms are and what the rib cage is and everything else. And it's very interesting and it's very poetic and it's actually worthwhile. But because you could read about that any place, I'm not going to worry about it today. And what people like Bourne and myself find interesting is what virtues a true leader has to have. Most of these guys are monarchists of one kind or another. John is no different in that respect. But John, like a lot of these guys, is going to hold that only certain people should ever be permitted to hold the supreme executive authority, whether it be in Great Britain or any other place in Christendom. And the first thing, and he holds this in common with everybody, almost everybody anyway in this era, is that the head of the body, the monarch himself, should think only of the whole. He should abandon any idea that he is an individual, that he represents a certain class or group of people, that the only thing that should ever concern him is not social forces, is not economics, not as separate disciplines, but it is the whole. It is the body and what works best for the whole, not for the part. Without that kind of attitude, you don't have a real monarch. The common good is the only moral concern of anybody who's been invested with the supreme executive authority. Now, what does that entail? That's the big issue. And really the central concern here is that any good monarch has to serve to protect the weak. The strong can take care of themselves. The strong nobles, military people, these guys can take care of themselves. They don't need the help of the state. The people who need the assistance of the state, and the reason why the state exists, is because you always have those who, for whatever reason, have fallen behind. They've fallen on hard times. Their crops have been destroyed. An invader may have harmed their home, their livelihood, and as a result, the monarch has to be particularly interested in the weak, those who are poor, those who are suffering. And I want to hold that throughout medieval political ideas, medieval political theory, you're going to see that the devotion to the poor people, those who for whatever reason have come upon hard times, is one of the main reasons that the state, the government, has ever come into existence. The reason it's come into existence is to help those who cannot help themselves. But as really part and parcel of protecting the poor and the weak, it's also the idea of controlling the bureaucracy. Now, we're talking about the High Middle Ages here. We're talking about an era, post-Roman era, where bureaucracy is just getting back on its feet again. And John of Salisbury is interesting because he's recognized that the bureaucracy is something that can be a problem in its own right. It's a problem in its own right because it has its own interests apart from the government, apart from the common good, but also because those who staff the bureaucracy are those who are, you know, powerful. You only get to these kind of positions in the High Middle Ages when you already have the power to assert yourself in public life. So one of the things that come from this idea of the common good is, number one, the protection of the weak, and number two, controlling the strong, which the way John views it is controlling bureaucrats, making sure that they don't have too much power. Now, as far as the monarch is concerned, the monarch must reject luxury. The monarch must not live in splendor. The monarch must not live in beautiful clothes and eat, you know, the most sumptuous meals. He has to live the life of his subjects. You know, the whole idea behind John of Salisbury's political theory, and this is relatively radical for the Middle Ages, is that society was originally good. People were good. People were happy. People, generally speaking, lived in support of one another. But as private property, as social groups became more and more entrenched in their own interests, people became corrupt. And once people became corrupt, due to the fact that they began to form different classes and have different interests and have different ideas on what will serve those interests, only a monarchy, a strong state, came into existence only to serve the common good. A monarch can only be a monarch if he is above and beyond classes. He has to be beyond classes. He has to be beyond factions. That's what the state is for. We know that there are rich and poor and middle class, that there are religious and secular people, that there are strong and weak people, there's smart and dumb people. We know that. And we know, unfortunately, that the smart and well-endowed mentally and those who have a lot of money will always be able to impose their will on the rest and enslave them. There has to be a countervailing force to that, and that is the nature of the state. The state comes into existence only to serve the common good that no actual individual has any desire to promote the common good. Individuals, the point of all this is that no individual has the desire to support the common good, only the monarchy. People who were born and raised to support the common good, these people should be placed in a position of power. Without the state, all you really have are factions fighting each other, with the final end of the powerful enslaving the weak. Any prince who rejects this approach, which according to John of Salisbury is the very basis of natural law, something that God himself has placed within our human nature, anyone who rejects this approach, any prince, any monarch who is a factionalist, who supports the rich over the poor, the powerful over the weak, should be disobeyed and replaced. And as a result of this, see, the understanding that God has placed this understanding in the heart and soul of every individual. They might not want to deal with it. They might, only want to support their own interests. But princes are, in monarchy in particular, when I say the state in this case, I'm referring to monarchy only. The state and the state alone has come into existence through God's law for the sake of creating and protecting the idea of the common good. Rather than creating the common good, I should say manifesting and protecting the common good. And as a result, monarchs should be pious. They should realize that this common good is something that God, the Logos himself, has placed in the heart and soul of every individual. And it is the purpose of monarchy to make sure that people recognize and understand this. Now, when you have a monarchy, you must have a monarch. This monarch is the very representative incarnation of the common good. But a law is only a law, and a prince is only a prince, to the extent that they legislate, act, and live according to this idea of the common good. If they do not, they're not princes anymore. They become tyrants. A law that is opposed to the common good is not a law. It's a demand, a personal demand of a tyrant. A law, by definition, is only that which supports the common good. Anything else is merely the personal, libidinal demand of a tyrant. So when you say, I am a supporter of the law, all you're really saying is, I am a supporter of the common good, natural law, and the God who created the idea of natural law. So the monarch has to maintain a certain decorum. A monarch must be chaste, have one wife and one wife only. He must be humble. He must not believe that his position is an excuse to justify or exalt himself. He must be knowledgeable. A monarch must be educated. He must recognize his own people's history, its religious history, the history of Greece and Rome, and be able to take lessons from that history. He must take moral action in society. John of Salisbury says that prostitutes need to be cleared from the streets, that the theaters need to be shut down, because these are really the ways that prostitutes manifest themselves to the world. And certainly we could say the same about the American media. He's talking about his own media. He hates actors and actresses because he holds them as really identical to prostitutes. That justice has to exist and law must exist, but the manifestation of the law should be enforced with mercy. It's not just a matter of, you break a law, you receive a certain punishment. No, you break a law, but the monarch or his judges should be there to take all circumstances into account. That the law should be manifest at all times, but that manifestation should always be tempered with mercy. And that, like almost all these people who we're going to deal with today, and the next time this show airs, we're going to see that all of these writers talk about how important your counselors are. Those people who you bring into what we would call today a cabinet, those who advise you, these should be older people, they should be pious, they should be experienced people, respected by the community at large. And that ultimately, the welfare of the lower classes, those who are suffering, this is the real main thrust of state power and law. He's not talking about, radical equality here, but he is talking about the necessity of making sure that the lower classes are not permitted to fall into complete oblivion. Ultimately, John of Salisbury really deals in his major political work with the concept that liberty and virtue are inseparable things. There is no such thing as liberty without virtue, and there's no such thing as virtue without liberty. But he also holds the idea that the counselors of the prince, those who are involved and active politically, should be given absolute free speech. You know, he's talking about, you know, counselors and scholars who advise the prince, people who are active in politics, need to be able to approach the monarchy with complete freedom and be able to talk about things that might be unpopular, that might make the ruler angry, but that kind of freedom needs to be preserved and promoted because the prince can never be a dictator. There is, of all the great royalist writers and theorists of this and many other eras, none of them believe that a monarch should be a dictator. A monarch might be an icon of stability or piety, but never to rule without wise counsel. And those counselors should be respected, but should be able to speak and act freely. Ultimately, the tyrant, those that reject the common good, those that reject the idea of freedom, amongst those virtuous counselors of the prince, people who know the people, who know the land, who know the society, who can assist in the education, continued education of the monarchy, that these people, if they are to be suppressed, if they are to be told to shut up, then the prince needs to be replaced. John of Salisbury, like most monarchists, hold that the prince must be virtuous, the prince must guarantee freedom of speech in the political realm, and the prince can never rule by himself. This is central. This is going to show up in all the major writers and figures of the High Middle Ages that we're going to deal with over in this program and in the next one as well.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
The next person we're going to deal with is Giraldus Cambrensis, who is not as well known as John of Salisbury, another figure of the High Middle Ages, also a royalist, as most medieval political writers are. And like John of Salisbury, he begins his work by supporting the idea that the prince, the monarch, must live not for himself, not for his office, but for the whole, the entire body of the population, with no exceptions. And that the primary virtues of royal rule are, number one, mildness. That the monarch has to learn to control his temper. He must subject the population to the law, no question about that. All of these people are law-based people. It's very rare in the Middle Ages to find anyone who holds that a monarch is somehow above the law in any meaningful sense. It does not exist in the High Middle Ages. But mildness is something else. The concept of mildness is that the law should always be obeyed, but that doesn't mean that it should be enforced in such a way where mercy and the other virtues have no place. People are sinful. people are weak. A monarch should know this, and therefore, outside of the most outrageous criminals, especially powerful ones, a monarch has to be lenient in how these laws are actually enforced on a day-to-day basis. The second concept is dignity. The head of state must always be dignified, can never show temper, can never show anger, has to present himself as a solid rock, has to be above the common people in that he must be better in a moral sense than the common people. A lot of these guys we're going to deal with here treat the monarch as someone who has far greater responsibility and far greater moral standards than the common population. The monarch has to be an icon. The monarch has to be an icon of God, of Christ, and has to be impassible. He has to show the best example of how to deal with your opponents, how to deal with stressful and difficult situations. Has to be the rock of stability for the population. And what you're going to see in the High Middle Ages in terms of political theory is that the monarch must be loved more than feared. Because the fact is that love derives from the respect and devotion of the population to a dignified and merciful ruler. You only end up having to rely on fear when you are not respected by the population. But Giraldus is one of these guys who holds that the private life of the monarch is just as important as the public life of the monarch, and that any monarch, any head of state, must be highly virtuous in his private life. See, we're talking about an era when the main celebrity of a society is the monarch and a handful of his noble counselors. This is the media of the age. The monarch is the media. The monarch is the message. That's why symbolism is so important. And today we have this pagan Olympian pantheon of celebrities that have been promoted by the Jewish media to really reinstitute the old pagan gods and goddesses. You have gods of love and you have gods of war, depending on the different movies and celebrities, male, female, what they look like, how they act. You know, but we're talking about a time prior to the worship of celebrities, and really the only celebrity worth anything in the High Middle Ages, of course, is the saint, the holy man, the holy woman, and the monarch. So that means that these people have tremendous responsibility, and private life, public life, there is no difference. The manifestation of natural law and the love of country and the love of the common good, as encapsulating all of that, has to be at the very center. Giraldus Cambrensis holds to the notion, like John of Salisbury, that patience is another one of the great virtues of a monarch, of a political ruler. We know that people are weak. We know that people are stupid. But a monarch has to be humble. A monarch has to realize that, well, no matter how smart I am or how free I am, well, I make mistakes too. I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I'm not going to be easy on myself, but hard on everybody else. I won't permit that. Not in the least. I need to be patient with people. If you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, you see this there as well. And I want to say that the Roman idea manifest by Marcus Aurelius is something very important to the High Middle Ages. And people are still reading him, of course, in the original Latin, in the High Middle Ages. Marcus Aurelius is a great man and a great writer, and a lot of this mentality carries over to the Middle Ages. And one of the things that Marcus holds to is that you either tolerate the ignorant and the self-interested, or you try to teach the ignorant and the self-interested. You can't let them dominate. You can't let them control things. But you must be patient with them, because that's how humanity is. The prince, the head of state, is the pattern for their subjects. before the age of the corrupted Judaic media. The prince, the monarch, he was the icon for the population. This was the pattern that everyone had to follow. And like everyone in this era, justice exists, law exists, but so does mercy. In the Russian world, you see this in writers like Nikolai Gogol, who hold that the great justification of monarchy is that the law isn't this automatic thing. The law has to be applied on a case by cases, but mercy and mercy alone should be the primary variable. Because we know how people are. We know that people are stupid. We know that they always do the wrong thing. We know that we're sinful, fallen people. And as a result of that, the monarch has to treat this kind of criminality with mercy and with the idea not so much of eliminating these people, but rehabilitating these people. And again, Giraldus holds that, a lot of these guys, and you see this in Machiavelli in the Renaissance, but this love and fear distinction, it comes up again and again in the Middle Ages. A lot of people forget about that. The idea is that Giraldus holds that love and fear aren't really all that different. That if you have a monarch, a ruler who is truly loved, that love will eventually turn into fear, but not necessarily of a bad, tyrannical kind. If you're dealing with a monarch, head of state, who is admired and respected, going against somebody like that should be a fearful thing. And therefore, love and fear, when we're talking about political kinds of things and dealing with monarchy, love and fear aren't all that different. Now, the fear of violent death is not the basis of any state. Not until the Enlightenment will you have the fear of violent death be the basis of the state. And people like Thomas Hobbes and later on in Russia, Peter the Great, will also have this idea. The state rests on fear, but that fear is only fear of violence and torture. No. In the Middle Ages, really the true Christian era, what you really have is that fear is based on love and respect. When you're dealing with a ruler who is loved, respected, admired, going against that person is fearful and usually is a very big error. Love and fear are not opposites when taken seriously. But like John of Salisbury, Giraldus holds to the view that learning and understanding are absolutely central to royal rule, specifically philosophy and history. These are the two ultimate political areas that you study. Philosophy in terms of dealing with first principles, metaphysics and ethics, and history, how this ethical idea has manifested itself over time. There is no political idea, there is no social theory outside of ethics and historical understanding. And, I probably don't need to say this, but it's pretty clear that nothing in modern political rulers have anything to do with what I've been talking about. These people are purely self-interested. They serve the wealthy and they care only about themselves and they care only about their particular self-interest and the people who finance them. So we're talking about, in the High Middle Ages, we're talking about a revolutionary theory. We're talking about what today in this still new 21st century, we're still talking about revolutionary ideas. The very fact that we talk about virtue and moderation and mercy, that is absolutely revolutionary in this sick Judaic day and age. So Giraldus holds that new laws, when you promulgate a new law, that this law should be placed into circulation very quickly. That the first few months or first few years of a new law, harshness should be the rule. Only as time goes on should you become more and more merciful. A new law should be manifest very quickly in the population. Should be very quickly carried out. Interestingly, Giraldus holds that capital punishment should only be used sparingly. Only with the worst criminals should you use capital punishment. What we need to do is worry about rehabilitating these people, bringing them back to society, showing them mercy, only for those who are so destructive that they could hurt the common good, these people should be eliminated. But that's only at the very last, only the very last resort. Ultimately, the great virtue of all monarchs, of all political leaders, is moderation, is mercy, it's dignity. It's the manifestation of the virtues. This is the nature of political rule. It is the manifestation, the actual incarnation of actual virtues in the life of the common population, treated as a single social entity, a nation. That's what we're talking about here. The last person I want to deal with this evening is Gilbert de Tournai. He's another one of these relatively obscure and yet in his day very important writer in social and ethical ideas. And with Gilbert, we're going to conclude. And then in part two, we'll do next week, we'll deal with William and Egidus and a few other people who are really truly worth our time in understanding the nature of virtue and what virtue means relative to political rule. Gilbert, like everybody else we're going to deal with, really, you know, defines political misrule as rule according to class status. None of these writers, the mainstream of political ideas in the High Middle Ages, they hated the idea of the strong oppressing the weak. These are Christians. They hold to the view that the weak have rights relative to the strong. You would never see this in ancient Rome or Greece. As brilliant as these pagan societies were, and they produced extraordinary things, the concept that the poor and the weak somehow have rights against the strong, you don't really have that kind of theoretical basis. By the time you get to the High Middle Ages, you have an entire literature that's laid out based on the concept of the common good, which is defined as making certain that the weak, that the poor, that the suffering, that those who can't help themselves are assisted by the state. And even more than that, that that's why the state has come into existence. So for Gilbert of Tournai, the main idea is that anybody who's been invested with political rule needs to mentally rise above faction, class, party, whatever, and see the universal, see the whole. That is the ultimate political virtue in the Middle Ages. It's something that exists all throughout the great writers, whether major figures or minor figures, throughout the Middle Ages. Without the common good, there isn't anything. Without the common good, there is no virtue. There is no politics. Politics is not about balancing interests, like you see in the American Founding Fathers, where balancing interests is the whole purpose of government. No. In the Middle Ages, you have the elimination of interests and the demand that there is this thing called the common good, and without the common good, there can be no politics, there could be no law, there could be no justice. What is the first duty, according to Gilbert, of political rule? The first duty is the destruction of evil. Evil is a political regime that's based upon a certain class demand. Whether it be the rich attacking the poor or the poor attacking the rich. The question is harmony, not domination. Justice is subjects living in peace with one another, in reciprocal peace, respecting in a reciprocal way the rights of one to another. It isn't radical equality. It isn't order or even liberty. It's all of these things taken together. It's the respect of one part of society to another. But Gilbert holds to the view that any political ruler, any writer of a constitution, anybody who has any power at all politically must be humble and must place himself under the domain and domination of the common good rather than his own interests or the interests of a particularly powerful class or group of people. Gilbert of Tournai holds to the view that any ruler must truly love the people. But then he says that loving the people is in your own self-interest. Because if you pass laws and support movements that create harmony in the society, overcome division in the society, you will become admired and loved and supported. And therefore, it's in your self-interest not to rule as a tyrant. The tyrant is the absolute manifestation of demonic irrationality, because in a tyrannical world, you will simply be hated. If you silence somebody, it doesn't mean that you have converted him. That's a tremendous danger, and it's something that shows up in the High Middle Ages. The education, not only of the monarch, but of the population, is absolutely essential. This is one of the great, great ways of creating harmony amongst the people, of spreading education. And I'm tired of people who hold that the medieval view is anti-education. That's utter garbage. All of these writers believe that the education of the governing class and the education of the common people is very, very important. All of these figures hold to that particular point of view. And like almost everybody else we're going to deal with here, making sure that your counselors and advisors are competent, educated, experienced, pious, that also is absolutely central. And Gilbert, like a lot of these guys, holds that a law must manifest common good to be law. Otherwise, it's simply a demand of a tyrant. A law that does not manifest the common good is a law, and therefore can safely be ignored. I want to clear something up for those of you who are not, how do I put this? Those of you who might be historically challenged. The idea of absolute monarchy is a creation of the Enlightenment. It's not a creation of the Middle Ages. Middle Ages generally was based on constitutional monarchy. I've pretty much proved that already with these writers, and laying down what the ideal of the medieval prince really is. But I want to hold the idea that a prince and a law that derives from the prince only exists as such to the extent that natural law and the common good are followed and manifest. Otherwise, you can rebel in whatever way you possibly can, even by the simple expedient of just not obeying such a law. Gilbert holds that the main evils that a government, that a monarch, has to stamp out, and he actually has three. They're kind of eccentric, but they are, first of all, bribery. Bribery manifests the idea of a powerful class, a rich people trying to buy their way into government. Number two, gambling. And I want to say that really gambling here, it's a way that the powerful swindle the poor out of their money. It's like today in these Jewish-owned casinos out in Las Vegas, where they take poor and lower middle-class people and swindle them out of their money. So gambling really, with this mentality, is kind of a... It's a means by which the rich control the poor. And then really, hypocrisy is the third evil. The idea that somehow private and public life are different, and that you can demand something in public life that you reject in private life as a matter of principle. He also says something else that's really worth considering. He says that clemency and mercy does not weaken justice, but in fact strengthens justice. Now, in all these three people who we're dealing with tonight, John Giraldus and Gilbert, they all hold that law is necessary, but so is mercy. That law and mercy need to be balanced. This is why a monarch, being the freest person in a society, needs to function. You can't just have a mechanistic application of law to people. Law should be applied, but it also should be applied with mercy and forgiveness. So, clemency, mercy, does not weaken justice. If anything, it attaches people to justice because they realize that government, the prince, who is the manifestation of the government, recognizes the weakness in people, the weakness in himself, the weakness in the nobility, the weakness in the rich, but also the weakness in the poor and dispossessed. In judicial proceedings, and Gilbert's actually very interested in how a trial should be maintained, Gilbert holds to the view that a witness and the testimony of a witness is the most important thing that a judge should ever take into consideration. Evidence is problematic. You see, a witness can be cross-examined. That's what makes a witness particularly valuable. Evidence can't be cross-examined. So the testimony of witnesses should be the primary thing in any trial. Evidence can be planted. Evidence is problematic. A witness, if he's skillfully cross-examined and examined, really is the basis of justice. Gilbert defines the tyrant. We've kind of hit on this to some extent already. Gilbert defines the tyrant as somebody who loves worldly pleasure and who exists solely for worldly pleasure. But I want to say that what's really happening here is that when they talk about worldly pleasure, you know, money and food and all this stuff, they're really talking about the life of the rich and powerful who seek to use the state for their own purposes. The good prince, as the very opposite of the tyrant, he acts only by necessity, not because he feels like it, not because it's in his interest to act, but he acts because he must for the sake of the common good. And then when he acts according to reason, not according to libidinal desire. So I want to talk, I want to conclude here today. We've dealt with three people, three pretty important figures in the beginning part of the High Middle Ages. John of Salisbury, Giraldus Cambrensis, and Gilbert of Tournai. These three figures lay out the basis of medieval social ideas relative to the state and the prince. Now, next week we're going to deal with William Perrot, Aigdes Romanus, Jacques Sisola, Pierre Dubois, Mazzilio of Padua, and another Englishman, Thomas O'Clevia. And those are the figures that we are going to conclude with, and we will have then given a basic survey of the mainstream political ideas in the High Middle Ages just prior to the Black Death and the Renaissance. And then we'll conclude. I have 8 points in particular to try to draw all of these people together and try to make sense out of the Middle Ages relative to its social and ethical ideas relative to the state and to the prince. And I think this is worthwhile because I think that we're dealing with things and ideas that today are a little more than revolutionary. And I think that these guys should be read. I think you should look them up. I think you should take them very seriously. So I want to thank everybody again. I want to thank my friends as well as my opponents. And I appreciate everything you do for me. I appreciate your comments. And I appreciate the voice of reason. And it's mission in the world. And I want to thank everybody for listening and paying attention. And I hope that I'm not too eccentric with all of this stuff. But, you know, that's just how I am. And that's what I like to do. So hang in there, folks. And I will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Oh,
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.